They're doing it? Maybe this is as close as we get in West County, you know. So I actually, this morning, had a couple of insights. One was I had this feeling how courageous you all are, you know. My sister has a lot of friends that are, you know, sort of extreme whatever, you know, triathlons or, you know, let's hike, let's climb 4,000 feet and, you know, hike 9 miles and do it in 4 hours or something, you know. But I actually think sitting here facing the wall and facing yourself is pretty courageous. It's amazing that we actually can do it, you know. And the reason we can do it is because we have the support of all of our intention, our deep intention. So I just felt that. I felt encouraged in that it was such a meaningful and worthwhile thing for us to be doing together. The second insight I had was there was a story that came to me. I don't know, long ago, the Christian tradition where there was a practice where people would meditate in a cell, you know, a monastic cell, for a year, praying, but in the dark, you know, as a metaphor, kind of in the, not complete dark, but in the dark. And then at a certain time of year, they would bring the monk or nun up into the church just at the time when the sun was coming through the rose window. And there was something about that experience, you know. And so this morning I thought, it was, you know, Chris and I alternate. You probably didn't know that. We try to switch back and forth. So I got this side. She had it last session. I had it this session. Sometimes it doesn't make much difference, but it isn't, you know, so conscious. But I got to watch the morning light, and I was thinking maybe next time we should all line up and just face, because it is so extraordinary. You know, Buddha was enlightened at the morning star, and we sit here, and it's not so obvious to us, you know, sometimes what we're doing. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. You know, we sit here, and it's not so comfortable in our bodies and in our minds, and we continue to sit. We have some sense of deep intention and purpose. But then if we do it enough, you know, we can, when we maybe leave, we notice that the sky is a little brighter. Things sparkle a little bit more, and we're a little bit kinder, less reactive, and just feel more settled because we've put the work in of being present and letting things go and letting the mind settle. You know, and just attending to our Buddha nature, which is there. So the Buddha was awakened with the morning star, you know. I looked out this morning, and the light was just, the eastern light was just coming over the trees, and the clouds were just drifting by, you know, all moving this way, south. And I was thinking, it's not a mistake that we use that as a metaphor for our practice, of the open, spacious sky and the clouds drifting through, because it really is. That's what we're doing. Moment by moment, we're just watching that process. And so how do we do that? Well, we practice. We have various practices with our body, with our mind, attending to our mind and our body. So today I'm going to, in our sangha we've been working on koans, and this morning I'm going to present to you, I've never lectured on this koan. I've been turning this koan for maybe 45 years, and I have never lectured on this koan, and it's probably the most famous koan. Most people, if you ask lay people, you know, what koan do you know? They give you this koan because, not because they've done it, but because it has, there's such a sense of humor about it. So the koan is Joshu, our friend Zhaozhou, the great teacher Zhaozhou, who I seem to keep coming back to. It was one of Dogen's, probably Dogen's favorite Tang Dynasty Zen masters, and also Suzuki Roshi. And I become very fond of Zhaozhou. You know, studied with his teacher for 40 years. You know, at 50, went out on the road at 50 for another 20 years, visiting with his staff, visiting various teachers, perfecting his, asking the right questions, turning the right questions, and then he started teaching at 80. So we're all, you know, we're all getting ready to manifest the Dharma. And I have this wonderful feeling about Zhaozhou, you know. And so this is Zhaozhou's. This in the, there, you know, several books of koans, and this one in the Gateless Gate is the number one koan. This is the koan that is given almost to every Rinzai student to start off with. It's probably, this koan is lectured on probably the first lecture of a seven-day session. Every single time there's a different lecture given on this particular koan. And so here's the koan. The koan is Joshu's Mu. Does a dog have Buddha nature?
Mu.
Mu. So mu means, mu in Chinese, mu in Japanese means no. So in the Gateless Gate, does a dog have Buddha nature? No. And that's, in that koan collection, that's it. Terse, to the point, easy to remember, and a little bit humorous, right? You have dog, you have a mu. That's easy to remember, right? What could that possibly be about? So in our school, in the Book of Serenity, it's a little more lengthy. So I'm going to kind of work my way to that. Hopefully I'll work my way to how to turn this koan. There's various ways to turn this koan. So, you know, what is a koan? Some of you have studied koans and use koans. You all actually use your own variation of a koan. A koan just means something that you turn in your life, a question that you're turning in your life. You know, it could be, what is this anger about? You know, what is this pain in my heart about? You know, when you keep turning, there's some question that you're turning. But traditionally, it was more like, you know, a parable. It was like a story and something that was, you know, inspired people. There's a collection of, you know, Sugi Roshi happenings. You know, one of the ones which is probably going to turn into a koan, because we keep repeating it as a teaching example, is this guy named Ravain, who was one of these fanatic vegetarians, and he goes out, and Suzuki Roshi takes him to a place outside of Tassajara, and Ravain doesn't see much. He orders the cheeseburger, he orders the cheese sandwich, and Suzuki Roshi orders the hamburger. And then as it comes, Suzuki Roshi says, you know, that looks pretty good. I'll eat the cheeseburger. Would you like my hamburger? So that has all the ingredients of a good koan. You know, like, what's that really about? Is it really about Suzuki Roshi liking cheese sandwiches rather than hamburgers? No. It's about working with Ravain's idea, you know, where he's so constricted and so tight around this one idea, you know, about got to be a vegetarian or you're going to go to hell, right? So Suzuki Roshi's going to turn that around. He's going to try to turn this around. So the thing about Zen koans, though, there's a couple things. One is they tend to have a sense of humor about them, a certain sense of irreverence about them. And they make you work for the answer. They make you work a little bit. They move you into the mystery. They let you know that the truth is maybe not so obvious. You have to actually plumb the depths. And humor is very important in our practice, right? We find that the middle way, the balance. If we're too silly and we're too flip, and we're too casual, we're not going to find the answers we want. On the other hand, if we're too serious and we're too grim, you know, and the superego, it just gives our superego another opportunity to flagellate ourselves with all our imperfections, that's clearly not what the practice is about. So can we lighten up? Can we let go? And so these koans are usually about trying to help people to lighten up and let go. And they're trying to get us, they're trying to illuminate us, they're trying to enlighten us. So I thought I'd go to the Oxford Dictionary and look what the word for enlightened was. And I liked what I found. To enlighten means to make luminous, to give spiritual insight, to remove blindness from the eyes. Kind of like, you know, Amazing Grace. I was blind, and then I saw. So this morning when I looked, the sky is there every morning, you know, but you don't always see it with the same luminosity. What is it that enlightens one, enables one, prepares oneself to see the world as it really is in its true brilliance, where you can look and somehow all is right with the world? All the imperfection, all the suffering, and still you have this sense that the beauty of the world presents itself like the morning star, and all is right with the world. So in the Zen tradition, how you view enlightenment and hence how you view and work with koans makes a big difference. The Rinzai school, and you have to understand, have a little understanding of Japanese culture. Japanese culture is an extraordinarily profound culture. Everything the Japanese do is very intense and very perfectionistic. You don't just take a flower and put it in a vase. You put it in a certain kind of vase at a certain time of year with a certain color of vase and a certain kind of flower. And this intention and beauty of presentation speaks to the soul and speaks to the spirit and can really brighten one. And they do this everything. So you would expect that their spiritual practice would be this way. So koans originally probably started off, you know, as just parables, just stories that were encouraging. But in a certain period of time in Japan, what they did was the examples that we have, like we look at the morning star, and we see that as kind of a profound example of the beauty, intensity, and sort of the non-speakability of the unity of the universe. Well, the Rinzai school would pull for that experience. In other words, when they sat a sesshin, that was the sin qua non of why they sat, this kensho experience. And so they would use these koans as a way to try to awaken people. So that you would go in, you would take this koan, for example, you take mu, and you would repeat mu, you know, all during the session. Maybe you'd be doing this for years until you actually reached a point of concentration where you would break through into a certain enlightenment. And you'd go periodically, maybe two or three times a day, and you'd talk to the teacher about it. You can imagine the amount of concentration that would engender in you. And so koan practice was often reduced to like a simple phrase or a word that would help you reach that particular state. Our school is different. Our school tends to be what we call affectionately kind of grandmotherly Zen, which I actually appreciate. It's a little more like, I always say, walking in the mist or walking in the fog. You don't know you're getting wet, but if you keep doing it, keep putting your time in on the cushion, there's a transformation that's happening. We begin to, like to say, individuate from our small self to our big self. We trust. We have faith in that particular practice. So therefore, the way we use koans are a little bit different. We use them more as a sense of sort of encouragement and to bring insight, not to pull for these intense experiences. And in fact, Dogen, because Dogen's one of our main teachers, the phrase that he uses, as Chris mentioned yesterday, practice realization. If we just continue to sit and kind of cook on our cushion, you know, we put the time in and we observe how the mind works and we continually turn that colon, how does one think beyond thinking? You know, how do we do that? How do we let, have room for the discursive quality of the mind, but how do we continually let that go? What happens in that process over a period of time? And we start to observe that the mind settles. So let me give you that rather lengthy, you know, I told you it's taken me, 45 years, so I've given you kind of a lengthy preamble here. Let's look at the two koans. So in the Book of Serenity, the monk says to Jashu, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Jashu says in the Book of Serenity, yes, the dog does have Buddha nature. And the monk says, well, if it has Buddha nature, how come it's a dog? You know, if it has Buddha nature, how come it's manifested as a dog? And so forget about the dog. How about us? If we have Buddha nature, which is what Mahayana Buddhism is telling us, if we have Buddha nature, how come we're so mangy so much of the time, right? How is that? And Joshi's answer is really interesting. He says, because he knowingly, purposely offends. Well, you know, in law, you can do things negligently, and there's repercussions. But if you do things consciously, there's more serious repercussions. And that's true in terms of the law of karma. So in turning this koan, this answer, this is really profound, because on one hand, we do have Buddha nature. You know, when you read the Lotus Sutra, the Lotus Sutra is emphasizing that point. It's trying to move us into an excitement about the possibility of who we really are, what our potentiality is. And it's constantly reminding us that, in fact, we are Buddha. Really honor ourselves that way. Don't run around with the idea that you have original sin. Go around with the idea that you have original goodness. And it's just right there, ready to present itself to you, if you can just open up to that possibility. So what this koan is somewhat saying, Joshua is saying, yes, you do have this. You absolutely have this. And even no matter how you are with all your defilements, you're still going to have it. You can still appreciate and you can still love yourself. It's saying that. But it's also saying something else. You know, Dogen said in one of his fascicles, Raising the Bodhi Mind, he said, without the discriminating mind, we cannot awaken to the Bodhi Mind. So Joshi was saying something else here. He's also saying that to awaken to the Bodhi Mind, to your Buddha nature, you also need to work with the discriminating mind. You need to have the discriminating mind. So this is a beautiful way to integrate, a seamless way to integrate, you know, the universe, really. And when you really think about this, between the absolute and the relative, all these things we see as suffering are actually essential to appreciate the wholeness. We can't come to an understanding of our goodness unless we have something to give it relief, to see it in the background of. We can't understand what the mind, the awakened mind, is like unless we struggle with the discriminating mind. We can't understand what peace and equanimity is unless we experience the other side of it. So we actually need it. So those of you that have actually studied some of the Lojong teachings, you know, the 59 aphorisms, so the third point of mind training cuts right to that, which is welcome difficulties. Use the difficulties of your life. Begin to turn those in a way to see that these are essential for you to really awaken to your Bodhi mind. So he says yes. you do have your Buddha nature, and we do. But then the next monk comes and says, right, does the dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu says, no, he doesn't have Buddha nature. Because of his karmic consequences, that's why he doesn't have Buddha nature. So just when you were basking in the effervescence of your original Buddha nature, Joshu takes it out from under you and says, don't rest on your laurels. Don't rest on your Buddha nature. There are karmic consequences. You know, if you don't practice. It's like what he says in the Fukan Zazengi. Remember, we chanted it yesterday. He says, there is practice realization. Why do you need to practice? Why go anywhere? Why do anything? That's how he starts off, right? That's the first part of this koan. And the second part, he says, no, but Buddha had to do it. Bodhidharma had to do it. And then he sits down. He says, and here's how you do it. You sit down, you cross your legs, you maintain an upright position, and you pay attention to your mind. And you watch how the mind works. And you get to, through a process of beginning to think beyond thinking. So there really are consequences. We really do need to practice. We really do need to chant the precepts. So that part of practice is really true. So I didn't really understand that so much. You know, the koan that I've been working with for years, probably the one that's central, there's two that are central to me, but one is Suzuki Roshi's quote is, and it has a little bit of a sense of humor, right? It's such a beautiful saying. You are perfect just as you are. That's the first part of the koan, right? And you could use a little work. That's the second part of this koan. Yes, the dog has Buddha nature. No, the dog doesn't have. You don't. You've got to work for this. So you hold both. And it's so beautiful how this koan integrates both sides of that. Really beautiful for me. And I'm not sure I really understood that. I think I ignored this koan for years because it just seemed like, well, that's what the other school does. And the one that was presented to me was, does a dog have Buddha nature? So this is in the gateless gate. So this is another way to turn this koan. No. So what is this no about? You know, what's this mu about? How would you use this koan the way a Rinzai uses it? You know, the Rinzai tradition uses it. So, and this builds on what Chris was saying yesterday, because really what the heart of this is cultivating this attitude of question. This no is really what this is about a profound question, or what you may read about in Zen literature as sort of the great doubt. How do you arise the great doubt? What is this? How do you use no to do this? So the reason why it's number one koan is because, and it's the first koan that's given, is because to really progress on the path, you do need to have some concentration. So this koan is given as a way to start. One reason why this koan is given is to develop a sense and encourage you to understand that concentration is really an essential part of practice. You really do need to develop the capacity to sit still, some capacity to work with your mind, and some real discipline, you know, to be able to not just go with the discursive thinking, to be able to slowly be able to do the practice of dropping those thoughts and returning to zero. Dropping those thoughts, returning to zero. And so Mu will help you do that. Bob asked me yesterday in the question, he says, do you have a magic, what did you say? A magic mantra or something? Well, this is the magic mantra that the Rinzai school gives. They actually give a verbal phrase, like a bit of a mantra, you know. And if you were to use this phrase, I'm not actually not encourage you in you to use mu, but I would encourage you to maybe think about using a phrase periodically, and I'll give you some suggestions about how I do that. So a Rinzai practitioner would actually be saying, almost on every breath, mu, mu, Or you would say, or you could say, no, no. And then you'd breathe, and you'd stay with that no, no. And it would really help concentrate you, and that brings you through the gate, the first gate of practice, which is before you can develop insight, you've got, as we say in Zen, there has to be stopping and seeing. And so this starts to work on that first part, that you begin to stop, you begin to still the mind enough so you can actually see. But the koan goes deeper, actually. There is a phrase that they use in Korean Zen. A lot of Korean Zen practitioners use a phrase. And the phrase is, which is used the same way as the mu, is called, what is this? So you ask the question, what is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? And what's important is the question. It's like searching for the pillow in the dark. That's what that is. So you're not asking, you're not looking for an answer. You're only looking for the question. Where does the questioning put your mind? So if you were drinking tea and you were to say, what is this? It wouldn't be, what is the tea about? Or how does the tea taste? It's something pre. You know, it's like how you asked the question. It wouldn't be like, well, oh, what is this? It would be more like, what is this? What is this? It's like a sense, it moves you into a sense of wonderment, into a sense of openness, and the sense of being present. So the koan that I use occasionally is, and I gave it to you yesterday, Bob, is like present moment. So I'll be going along and I find that my mind's thinking a little bit and I'm trying to let go of the thoughts. And periodically I'll just say, what is this? What is this? So it brings me back, or I'll say, present moment. Present moment. Present moment. What is present moment? What is in this present moment? My body, my mind, the sky, present moment. So it opens you to a sense of wonderment. It opens you to a place of no place to rest. No expectation that it ought to be anything else than present moment. And this is exactly what the Heart Sutra is trying to do. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, we chant it during the ceremony, notice what the words are saying. No eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no space, no touch, no death, no ignorance, and also no extinction of it. It's the no, it's the mu, it's the taking away. Every time something comes, you something, no, no. So what that means, it is not a negation, it's not like it doesn't exist, but what is it? What could it be? What's beyond this? No place to rest. No need for knowledge. No need for security. Just this present moment is sufficient. And so how, when we're breathing, how do we bring to our breath? Because that is our primary practice. You know, and so does that. How do we bring that sense of intensity, that sense of inquire, that sense of presence to every breath? Just every breath. What is this? What is this? What could it be? You know. So it helps, you know, when we're in discursive mind or painful body, or we're not expecting anything else than that. So, you know, Sukhi Roshi, the third day of Sesshin, would say, I know your body's really hurting and you're really tired and everyone's thinking, yeah, and he's going to tell us it's going to get easier. And he says, yeah, it's going to go like on this forever. You know, it should have took it away from him, right? Any hope that it was going to be better. Like, what is it? Just present. What's this moment? Present moment. What is it? What could it be? So what koans can do is they can take you through the door. You know, it's the same on this side of the door as this side of the door, but it's different. In terms of how you look at it. The sky is different on this side of the door. And what they can engender in you is a sense of humility. You know, it's not like, I know, I got it figured out. What is it so then I know and I can figure it out? It's more a sense of humility, more a sense of, what could it be? What is it? You know? Wow. It could be, you could phrase it in the positive, you know? Yes, yes, yes. You know, it could be that side of the koan. The yes side of the koan. So, think of your breath. That's really the way we use. That's our koan, is our breath. You know, what is this breath? That's the gate. Where can it carry us to? How inclusive is it? What is it? And even beyond the breath, you know? The breath is also just a door, just a gate to take us. What could it be? What is this present moment? No expectation. Just but what it is. Here in this room, the sky, the cold, our lives, together. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to turn this koan a little more deeply. You know, usually we put a little more effort into working with the for when we do sesshin, feel some obligation to Buddha and to you and our own practice. Thank you for giving us that opportunity. Mm-hmm.